Good evening. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon, and for the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. It's Friday, so that means it's panel time, and we're joined by two brilliant minds, a man whose political commentary and analysis can be found at Counterpunch and on his website, thepolemicist.net, Jim Kavanaugh. Jim, welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And we're also joined by a former Washington Post bureau chief and award-winning foreign correspondent on two continents, John Jeter. John, it's great. Welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Always a pleasure, Doctor.
Let's start with, this is not a current news story for this week, but Jim Kavanaugh, you wrote a fantastic piece in Counterpunch called Avoiding Assange. And I wanted to spend just a couple minutes, and let me read a little bit of your opening. You write, the United States government is seeking to extradite and prosecute Julian Assange for one reason: to punish him for publishing true and embarrassing information about U.S. crimes and intimidate every journalist in the world from doing so again. If the U.S. government succeeds in doing this, it'll strike a devastating blow to the fundamental elements of democracy throughout the world. I say throughout the world because it is important to understand that the U.S. government in this case is asserting its prosecutorial authority over someone who is not an American and whose journalistic activity took place outside the United States. That is a succinct, clear, and in my humble opinion, very simple explanation of reality. Unfortunately, Jim, I'm not hearing that simple, clear assessment of reality in mainstream media.
Well, yeah, that was the point of my article. I mean, there's enormous amount of diversion and avoidance. There's a big avoidance mechanism going on. And basically, they're trying to replace that point with some other point that's supposedly the real issue. They want to divert your attention onto something else. Number one, that Julian Assange is, let's use the word jerk. You know, somehow that's the point. Or number two, that, you know, which the New York Times and the Washington Post are saying, oh, this indictment doesn't really, it's not really that bad because, in fact, it's a victory for the rule of law, says the Washington Post. And it's well done, says the New York Times, because it's not, it's about hacking, it's not about publishing. And then there's this debate, which is primarily going on in England, but that's extremely important because that's where Julian Assange is and that's where his fate will be decided. That, oh, really, we got to go back to the Swedish sexual allegations, and really the important thing for us to do here is to extradite him to Sweden. Literally, they're saying that, even though Sweden hasn't asked for him to be extradited anymore. So,
and Jim, last I checked, I thought those charges against him in Sweden had been dropped.
They have been dropped. They could be reopened. It's possible. But, you know, and this is why it's such a strange debate, because these people are going, well, really, what you have to do is pay attention to those to Sweden for some reason. What they're doing is replacing the actual extradition from England to the United States and saying that's not the important thing. The important thing to talk about and to commit ourselves to is to extradite him to Sweden if the Swedes should ask to do that again. It's the most bizarre debate, but there's a point to it, and the point to it is to get Jeremy Corbyn, who may be the prime minister, to say, oh, yeah, that's the important thing. The important thing, and it's to get everybody's attention off of the United States and off of what's going to happen to him and talk about something else. Replace the issue of Julian Assange being extradited and imprisoned for a long time in the United States with some other issue, whether it's the sexual allegations in Sweden or the fact that he was hacking and it's only going to be a 5-year sentence, which is a lot of baloney, and everybody, and I demonstrate that in the article, that everybody knows and that he's going to get more charges thrown at him. So, you know, it's really an avoidance mechanism that's going on to avoid the point that I stated, that you read and that I stated, which they don't want to talk about. Because people who are, especially the people on the liberal end of the spectrum, who don't want to come out and say, look, I'm supporting Julian Assange being thrown in jail for 20 years plus for publishing true facts about the United States, that when they were published in 2010, all the liberals were fine with, But they don't want to say that. So they say, well, let's not talk about that. Let's talk about what a jerk he is, or let's talk about the fact that it's really a victory for the rule of law that the Trump administration did so well in charging him only with hacking and avoiding these First Amendment issues, you know, and blah, blah, blah. So it's important that we not allow ourselves to be diverted and our attention to be diverted. This is all a means of supporting his extradition to the United States by changing the subject.
So, John Jeter, your thoughts on where we are with Julian Assange?
Well, I think, I think this is the final nail in the coffin for the news media, which, of course, has bent over backwards to assert that Julian Assange is not a journalist, which, of course, means that he is most definitely a journalist. And so I think the real loser in this is the media. I think the American people, whatever little faith we had in the news media, has really been destroyed over the last month with the revelation that Russiagate was nothing but a bag full of hot air, and that Julian Assange is being prosecuted basically for revealing war crimes by the United States, and the fact, the very inconvenient fact, that Hillary Clinton and top leaders in the Democratic Party worked to rig the primary nominating process and to steal the nomination from Bernie Sanders. So I think really the media and then democracy are what has been lost in the Julian Assange debacle.
And John, one of the points that Jim makes in his article, Avoiding Assange, which can be found at Counterpunch, is he says it's important to understand that the U.S. government in this case is asserting its prosecutorial authority over someone who's not an American and whose journalistic activity took place outside the United States. The U.S. is operating as the world's police here.
Oh, no question. And I think this is kind of a continuation of the, quote, war on terror, unquote, and the assertion first by Bush and then more notably by Obama that the president of the United States could behave like a king and kill anyone anywhere in the world without a scintilla of evidence. So now we've taken that a step further and we can prosecute, the United States government can prosecute anyone anywhere in the world for what is not even a crime. So, yeah, we're just going further and further down the spider hole here.
You know, John, I'm glad you made that point. And Jim, I'd like for you to respond to this as well, just to wrap this up, because your point about the president being able to kill anyone around the world, that was a statement, as I recall, made by then Attorney General Eric Holder. And if my memory serves me, he was speaking in the context of drone strikes, and he had killed a suspected terrorist and his son. I'm drawing a blank on the name, but the whole idea.
Anwar,
exactly. And the whole point was he could push a button on you. As Eric Holder said, the president of the United States has the right to execute an American anywhere in the world.
And remember, doctor, this was a constitutional lawyer trained at one of the finest universities in the world, who taught at one of the finest universities in the world. This was a constitutional lawyer. I say all that to say that, you know, we've gone down the spider hole, and now the question is, how do we get out of it? Well, you can't. You can't.
And Jim Kavanaugh.
Yeah, well, that's right. I mean, and it's important to know he targeted that person who was an American citizen outside the United States with no trial or anything. So he sentenced him to death on his say-so. What's happening here now, what you're seeing, which is interesting with the Assange case and other things like the sanctions, et cetera, you know, the United States is telling Britain that you have to arrest a citizen of Australia and send them to the United States for breaking American law. So they're telling countries around the world, you have to enforce what we say is our law against other citizens of other countries and bring them into your country and then send them to us. It's a journalistic rendition.
It's frightening.
Now. And it's universal jurisdiction. The United States has universal jurisdiction in the world, and it's got to get the other countries to agree to this. And unfortunately, countries like the UK and most of the European countries are going to agree to it. But it's just amazing. That's what they're doing with the sanctions now. Oh, you can't buy oil from Iran. You know, who are we going to sanction you? And we're going to sanction you, every company that does this. So our law says no oil, no buying oil from Iran. But your company in France or Italy will punish them.
It's frightening. It is frightening. Next subject, Joe Biden joins the 2020 Democratic presidential race. As I listen to the morning cable shows, the coverage now seemed to become all Biden all the time. And Joe Scarborough, of all people, would have you believe that Biden not only walks on water, but he also parted the Red Sea. John Jeter, your thoughts now that Biden has entered the Democratic field, what does this do for the country? I mean, it's no surprise that he was jumping in, but just your thoughts on Biden's third attempt.
I think it reflects the distance between the elites, particularly the Democratic elites, and average people of all partisan stripes, that Biden believes, obviously, that there is some legitimate path to victory, both in the Democratic primary and, I would assume, against Trump. I don't believe there is a legitimate path to victory for a, you know, we'll be generous and call Joe Biden a moderate candidate. But Joe Biden has, his political career has been based on attacking working class people generally, vis-a-vis his draconian bankruptcy law that he wrote and sponsored. Let's be honest, African-Americans in particular, he got his start, as we learn, from Patrick Colburn, one of the last remaining really sort of working journalists in the United States, someone who actually does investigating and reporting. We learn that he got his start as an anti-busing crusader, and he was very much a part of that 60s backlash political generation that came of age in the early 70s. And so, you know, what I find striking is that there is no legitimate path to victory for a moderate candidate. We see this in terms of the candidates who have announced and how they all are backing a proposal, or at least some form of a proposal, to provide reparations to African Americans, to the descendants of slaves. That's extraordinary, right? We've never in history had even one candidate for either party propose or champion a race-specific idea, proposal as bold as reparations. And we've got, what, I think four or five who have openly embraced the idea of reparations. That is because they realize they need the black vote. Any Democrat needs the black vote, not only to win the nomination, but especially to win against Trump. Black turnout, voter turnout declined for Hillary Clinton. They are conscious of this, and they're trying to rectify it. But the point is, Joe Biden, I don't believe he can put the genie back in the bottle. He has made his career off antagonizing black people vis-a-vis his omnibus crime bill. And I don't believe he can do that. I don't think there's any legitimate path. They can try to rig it like they did 2 years ago, 3 years ago. I just don't know if they can pull it off two presidential election cycles in a row. I'm not convinced they can do that twice in a row.
Jim Kavanaugh, your thoughts?
Well, yeah, Biden is in the curious position of running against himself. I mean, he's got to get up every day and say, oh, I was wrong about this. You know, I apologize to Anita Hill. I was wrong about, you know, my statements about the crime bill, which was the, you know, mass incarceration of African-Americans that have helped to destroy African-American communities around the country. Oh, I wasn't right about that. And it hasn't been pushed so much yet on the bankruptcy bill, which John mentioned, and it really has devastated people's lives, makes people debt slaves forever because they can't even declare bankruptcy for their student loans, and plus, you know, a bunch of other bad consequences. So he's in this position where he's running against his former self, not just in one little thing, but in a whole bunch of very consequential things. And as John says, I mean, in the Democratic Party today, with the base that's been energized, or the big portion of the base that was energized by Bernie Sanders and is still in there because of the ideas that Sanders has put on the table and because of what they want to see happen that want to see the kind of changes in the country that Sanders represents, they're not going to go along with Joe Biden. You know, this is really, again, the Democratic establishment, and as John says, the general elite of the country, which is, oh, this is one of us. He deserves this. You know, he deserves to be the president because he's been around so long being one of us, and we all thought he deserved to be the president, so therefore he deserves to be the president, and that's really what he's running on.
You know, in listening to Morning Joe this morning, Joe Scarborough, as they brought up Anita Hill, as they brought up his vote on invading Iraq, Joe kept saying, well, you have to understand the context and the time. When Joe Biden voted in favor of invading Iraq, everybody was behind it. 74% of the American people were behind it. It was a year after September 11th. President Bush was in the Oval Office, and the intelligence people were saying, it's a slam dunk. You can't sit here now drinking your lattes in 2019 and blaming Joe Biden for what he did. And I thought to myself, first of all, George Bush created the Office of Special Plans in the Pentagon to corrupt the data, to obfuscate the truth. So you can't create the agency that hides the facts and then say, well, I didn't get the facts. That's the first thing. And now getting back to Biden, okay, Joe, I'll give you the bad vote on Iraq. Let's just say for the sake of argument, I'll give you the bad vote on Iraq. But you were sitting right next to Barack Obama when he decided to push the button on Muammar Gaddafi. You doubled down on the Iraq stupidity and took it into Iraq. And now where are you on Venezuela? So what we have there is American imperialism. That's what this is. This isn't Joe Biden just being Joe Biden. This is a guy functioning as an American imperialist operative, in my humble opinion.
If I can just chime in very quickly, Doctor, I think Joe Biden is the Democratic face of American imperialism as much as anyone. Maybe the exception being his boss, Barack Obama, a black man who enforced white supremacist and imperialist policies around the world against darker skinned working class people. But Joe Biden is certainly up there. If there's a Mount Rushmore of American imperialism today, Joe Biden is on it. But more importantly, I think this is what we have to look forward to from a Joe Biden campaign. And I think his advisors would do well to note this. It's much like, you know, our favorite slain revolutionary Fred Hampton said, you know, Joe Biden's campaign is very likely to leave us with answers that don't answer, explanations that don't explain, conclusions that don't conclude. I don't see any other way out of that sort of vicious circle for Joe Biden. He's got to backtrack basically for his entire 40-year career. I don't think it's possible.
Jim Kavanaugh, to add to that, he was talking about the Anita Hill fiasco. And what I see with Joe Biden was doing what a lot of white men do. They, A, think too much of themselves. B, they disrespect and ignore women. And C, disrespect and ignore black women. So Joe Biden was doing what a lot of white men in America have done throughout the entire history of the country. And what do we see with him being the hugging, kissing, hair-smelling bandit? He's still disrespecting the space of women. Am I right?
Yeah, he's totally clueless about that. That's for sure.
But I mean, that just shows a mindset.
And you watch these, I mean, the expressions you see on the faces of these women, he's grabbing from behind and coming up on their necks and their hair. It's really priceless. But, you know, so and the Anita Hill hearing was, you know, I remember it. I was just outraged at the time. You know, this woman was treated like this. And they deliberately kept out, you know, testimony from other women who would corroborate it. And
exactly.
He's saying today, oh, I'm sorry, I wish I could have done something else about it. What do you mean? You were the chairman of the committee. You wish you could have done something else about it. And I want to go back to what you said about just Joe Scarborough, because I think this is an important point. This line, oh, at that time, nobody knew what was coming. Baloney. There were the largest demonstrations in the world, throughout the world, and in the United States, millions of people out on the street. There were people who were speaking up against it all around the world. But it goes back to the point that John made very eloquently, I think, in an interview with Black Agenda Report. The media just decided not ever to represent that stuff again. And at the time of after 9/11, they eliminate Phil Donahue was kicked off the air. Anybody who was an anti-war voice was kicked off the air. No, it wasn't because the American people were dying for this. They might have, you know, they were promoted. This was promoted relentlessly by the press, despite the fact there still was an anti-war movement in the United States. It wasn't until Barack Obama that was done away with, that was destroyed. And throughout the world. So a lot of people knew this at the time. It's like saying, you know, there was, nobody was against slavery in 1861. No. There were a lot of abolitionists out there. There were a lot of people who were against it. The people, and as you said, George Bush had to make a determined effort to fake the data and to scrub the data. So that's a line that we shouldn't accept from people. You know, it's not really true that everybody was for it.
And I was on the air at that time telling people that this wasn't correct, that this wasn't true, that it was impossible for Saddam Hussein to have biological. I had engineers, biological engineers on the show explaining why in that hot environment you couldn't have mobile biological weapons labs traversing the desert because the environment that you would have to maintain them in would require so much electricity in space that you could have identified a thing from a satellite. It just didn't make any sense. Anyway, go ahead. And then I got to get out.
If I can very quickly.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting too. Joe Scarborough, I saw the Independent from London is touting Joe Biden. And it's so reminiscent in my mind of the stop Bernie Sanders campaign within the Democratic Party and within the elite circles of Washington, D.C., in the Beltway, inside the Beltway, is reminiscent of the Stop Jesse campaign led by Bill Clinton, Al Gore, the Democratic Leadership Council, 30 years ago, almost exactly 30 years ago.
Great point.
It's like history may not repeat itself, but it sure does rhyme, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's a good point. That was the most radical campaign that had been running the Democratic Party for a long time, and they did everything they could to stop.
And it was because of that campaign that we got Barack Obama. Because,
yeah, exactly right.
Because in order for Jesse Jackson to get out of the race, it was Dr. Ron Walters that came up with the idea that what we're going to do, you got to change the way that you proportion your delegates. And
it
had to go through proportional representation. And it was proportional representation that kept Barack Obama in the game.
Right.
Folks got to understand that history. Jim Kavanaugh, John Jeter, stay with me. It's Friday. It's panel time. And so we've got John Jeter. We've got Jim Kavanaugh. And Jim Kavanaugh's piece, Avoiding Assange, you can find at Counterpunch, as well as his site, thepolemicist.net. There is a whole lot more on the other side, folks. Stay tuned. We are back, and you are listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. It's Friday, so that means it's panel time, and we have with us Jim Kavanaugh. Go to thepolemicist.net or go to Counterpunch and read Jim's piece, Avoiding Assange. Fantastic, fantastic piece. Jim Kavanaugh's there, and we've got John Jeter with us. Gentlemen, thank you so much for staying with me. Another issue, Pentagon set to expand military role along southern border. The Pentagon is preparing to loosen rules that bar troops from interacting with migrants entering the U.S., expanding the military's involvement in Trump's operation along the border. Basically, they're going to move about 300 troops, and they're going to be military lawyers, cooks, and drivers to assist with handling a surge of migrants along the southern border. According to the Washington Post, this is going to cost about $21.9 million through the end of fiscal year 2019. Jim Kavanaugh, is this the beginning of a slippery slope of getting the military more involved? Because right now, the military is supposed to be prohibited from engaging in direct action.
Yes, I think that it is. I think that when you look at it, there's hardly another reason for it except to make another step in that direction. You know, they have to make waivers to allow them to do this. And it, as you say, it's cooks and lawyers and drivers. I mean, this is not a military action here. And the military lawyers, of course, don't know anything about immigration law. They're not really going to help. You know, this is the function they're supposed to perform should be performed by agents who are trained to do that. And you fund that and you do that if you want it. But this is just an excuse to get the Army in there and involved in a way that's quite dangerous. And it's all about, you know, everybody's avoiding the issue here, which is that these waves of people and families who are coming and trying to surrender themselves the minute they get across the border, you know, this is imperialism. This is the effects of American imperialism in Latin America. And unless you deal with that, you know, this is an immigration situation, you know, that's different from what we've had before, where young men were coming to get jobs. These are whole families coming to escape horrible forms of oppression and murderous violence.
John Jeter, to Kavanaugh's point, the military lawyers they're not immigration experts and attorneys, and they're sending cooks, but no bottle washers. Your thoughts on this, man?
Well, I can't remember the Latin term that lawyers use. The thing is as it appears.
Res ipsa loquitur. The thing speaks for itself.
Man, yeah. being your friend is like befriending a reference desk at the New York Public Library, Doctor. You have the answer for everything, but that's what it reminds me of. And you know, I think as horrific as it is, and it is horrific. I mean, we're militarizing our apparatus for dealing with people who are extremely vulnerable, and that's horrific. It is. It's bordering on a fascist state. The one advantage possibly, though, is that I think the more that we sort of antagonize immigrants, particularly from Latin America and South America and the Caribbean, the more I think we radicalize their family who are here, their relatives and friends who are already here. And I think that can form, it's not a given, but it can form the basis for a really progressive majority of blacks, of Latinos, and of progressive whites.
Jim Kavanaugh, that's a great point. From antagonism to radicalization, that's a fantastic point.
Well, that's what unfortunately, I mean, that theoretically is true, and I hope it is true. But people thought, you know, that Trump himself, and this is part of that. This is part of Trump being such an outrageous character that the idea is that he will energize people to mobilize in some way. But again, we got to go back to, I don't know what that's going to translate into politically in the United States. If the Democratic Party puts up a Joe Biden or a Beto or a Buttigieg, you know, I mean, what do you got? I mean, this political energy that's out there has to go somewhere that's going to have a political effect. And that's, I really don't have... I can't be helpful about that to a certain extent. You know, I mean, the Sanders campaign or the Tulsi Gabbard campaign, but Sanders is clearly in the lead of this, would be something positive and would have would go somewhere that was definitely a step in the right direction. But I don't believe the Democrats are ever going to let them win. And I think we have this problem of these energies of anger and frustration that are real, but they don't have a place to go. Politically effective.
And not to go back to the Joe Biden conversation, but Jim just made a very interesting point. John, does Joe Biden, in a sort of reverse way, open space for Bernie Sanders?
Oh, I think he definitely does. I think the contradictions become so clear with Joe Biden in the race. I mean, it's almost, you almost want to ask the Democrats, why didn't you just get Hillary Clinton to run again, right? Because they make the contradictions so clear. But to Jim's point, which I think is excellent, I think it is the question in the United States right now, which is, can the people organize in such a way to pressure their political leaders, to pressure the Democratic Party, to allow, I think, the inevitable nomination of Bernie Sanders to go through, to pressure Bernie Sanders once if he is in office, to pressure him to do the right thing and not be captured by the deep state, right? I think that's the question. Can we do that? We're at that critical moment. You know, when you're at that critical moment in history, there's no sort of like sign in Times Square that says, okay, this is a critical moment in history. This is 1933, right? And we're back in this hole again, and we have to figure out a way to dig out. And I'm no Pollyanna. I'm not sure that we will. I know that we can, right? But, you know, this is, I don't mean to berate the American people, but, you know, for 40 years, we've been told that we are a nation of tribes, that some tribes are lesser than others, that if they worked hard, everything will be fine, that you can be rich too if you just do as we do. And so, you know, right now, to put it very bluntly, we're about to find out, can you fix stupid? I don't know the answer to that, but can you fix stupid? We'll see.
Wow.
We're gonna see the next 2 years, I do believe.
Jim, can you fix stupid?
Well, I don't know. I mean, the problem is that the stupidity, and I'm not against that word. I don't think it means innate stupidity. I think people have been educated to be stupid, politically educated.
Indoctrinated to be stupid.
But you've had this Fox effect for 20 years now, and it's given rise to a kind of mirror image thing in the MSNBC and NPR, where they're all, but you know, they're never questioning the basic issues of the economic inequality and what generates it, and imperialism, and the wars, and the military spending. They don't question that. So you've had 40 years of a population that's been saturated by the liberal and conservative press in ways that I think make them stupid in a certain sense, make politically incapable of getting beyond a certain point. So I don't know what you know. We need a media. We need to challenge that in some way. And there is, it's out there in the alternative media and on the internet. But it's hard for even people to know how to get there and what places to look for. There's plenty of junk, and there's all. So it's still have most people getting their views from the network television or cable television, and most of the things on there are just terrible. So it's generating a kind of inability to think. As we would say, politically in a way that's productive and which channels that anger and real anger that everybody has about the situation in a way that's politically productive.
Jim Kavanaugh and John Jeter are my guests. It is a Friday. It's panel time. Related to the border story, tangentially related to the border story, Supreme Court's conservatives appear likely to let Trump add citizenship question to 2020 census. The Supreme Court's conservative majority seemed willing Tuesday to defer to the Trump administration's plan to add a citizenship question to the 2020 census, despite evidence, and let me say, overreaching, overarching, just irrefutable evidence that it could lead to an undercount of millions of people. The lower court judges, and this all comes from Wilbur Ross, the Secretary of Commerce. He wants to add this census question, the citizenship question. Three lower court judges rebutted Ross's claim that the information that he says he needed is requested by the Justice Department to enforce the Voting Rights Act. John Jeter, your thoughts?
Well, you know, again, the
contradiction. Wait. First of all, John, stop laughing.
I mean, you either have to laugh or cry at what's going on in the United States of America. It's what my African friends used to tell me: the last kicks of a dying mule. Right.
Yep.
That mule is almost dead, but he's got those last few kicks, man. It's just ridiculous. You know, we become this completely lawless state, you know, and we've always been lawless to a certain extent, but now it's almost complete, almost total.
Well, we haven't been lawless. We've been immoral. We have.
Yes, that's true. Yeah, you're right. That's more to the point. We've been immoral. And you know, it's like, you know, Amy Césaire used to say, the great Martinican politician and writer and thinker, you know, The colonial state and imperialism is a betrayal of reason, of the values of the Enlightenment. And so, of course, you know, asking people for their citizenship, you know, it's going to lead to an undercount. They don't care because this, the politics of austerity means they weren't going to fund any kind of programs or services for those people anyway, right? But it's not the intent. This is all just sort of smoke and mirrors leading to this sort of denouement. And it's coming, but I don't think people understand. It's sort of like, you know, back in the day, you know, Wilmer, we are at the certain age where we remember, you know, Mike Tyson in the ring and, you know,
right.
puffed up young. You might say, oh, I could take him. I could take him. But you don't really want that smoke. Right. I don't think the Republicans, they don't want that smoke either, right? They don't realize, though. They don't, they're so used to having their way that people have been pacified. We have been, you know, as Jim made the point, we have been made stupid, right? You can't get around that. I don't think we're innately stupid. I don't think the American people are innately stupid, but we've been forced to re-identify ourselves, you know, as members of this tribe, and it's not who we are. And so I think, you know, we're trying to put that square peg in a round hole, and you know, one way or another, it's all going to burst at the seams. One way or another, we just have to see how. I think at this point,
man, I had one of them Fisher Price building sets. I never could get that square peg in the round hole, no matter how hard I use that hammer. Jim Kavanaugh, an undercount is estimated by census officials. They're going to undercount by about 6.5 million people, probably in urban areas with large Hispanic and immigrant populations, many whom they assume would vote Democrat. This is voter suppression, man.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It does affect the funding for those communities.
Right.
And it affects a lot of things. And if you want to find out an accurate number of the people, and it's not just American citizens in the area, you have to do that. And people have very good reasons to be afraid. You know, immigrants and non-American citizens have very good reasons to be afraid to answer that question. And Greg Palast, I just saw, did something about that. We pointed out that Eric Holder actually said, because the whole shtick is that, oh, no, the census report is private, total privacy law. But Holder actually said, well, no, there's an exception for the Patriot Act. The Patriot Act allows us to get information about non-Americans from the census reports. So, you know, there are all kinds of reasons for people to be afraid to answer that question, and it is going to result in them undercount. And it was Wilbur Ross's people themselves who told him it would be 6.5 million people. So they don't care about that. It's a little bit like the inverse of the issue with the prison populations, which was like slavery. They want to count the prison population as part of the population of the area, but they don't want to let them vote.
There you go. There you go. They want to count the three-fifths compromise. The three-fifths compromise.
They want to not count the people in the area where it's a Democratic area. And of course, they can't vote anyway, so they won't get any. And so the Democrats will lose votes, will lose power in the state legislatures and in the gerrymandering of the districts. So it's a trick, and it's a scam, and it's voter suppression of the worst kind. And it's a suppression of kind of fundamental facts. Now, you know, the problem is that, you know, on a kind of abstract level, what's the problem with answering that question? It's done in a lot of places. It's done in a lot of places. You know, everybody, they do it in this country and that country and the other country. But you've got to look at the concrete social real effects of it. And that's what, you know, you've got to be able to think through. And I think that at the end of the day, the Supreme Court will probably go along and let, you know, the prerogative of the executive to ask this question if they want. And as Brett Kavanaugh said, not my family, you know, if the Congress wants to forbid this, the Congress can forbid it.
I need to go to a break, but so let me ask you guys if you could keep your answers to about just a minute and a half each on this. When you mentioned Brett Kavanaugh, my next question was going to have to do with Roberts and the court and the conservatives. They think it's going to come down to a 5-4 vote. The conservative justices are going to approve Wilbur Ross's question. The more liberal thinking justices will reject it. John Jeter, is Donald Trump getting from his court what he sent his court there to do?
Oh, I don't think there's any question. And I think a big part of that, again, not to sort of you know, beat a dead horse over and over again. But
or a dying
reason
mule.
That he's or a dying mule, right? The reason he's getting his way, I think, is because the media, as Jim has pointed out so eloquently, the media is distracted looking at other things that have no real impact on our lives, and so he's almost been able to do these things. What he's done to education, what he's done to the court system, you know, what he's done to labor regulations and the enforcement of labor laws, he's been able to get away with so much stuff, right? Only merely because the media is not doing its job and actually serving a watchdog function. They're looking at Russia. Russia has nothing to do with the water in Flint still being poisoned. Nothing. And so, yeah, I think definitely. Donald Trump is having his way, no question.
Jim Kavanaugh, about a minute and a half on that answer.
Well, I say also this is the culmination of a strategy that the liberals thought would be useful for 20 years. Let's depend on the Supreme Court. We can always depend on the Supreme Court. No, you can't. The Supreme Court is fundamentally a conservative institution historically. Everybody has to realize that. And what they don't want to do, and they've been avoiding, is fighting the political fight on the issues. If you want to forbid that question on the census, the Congress could do that, you know, and the Supreme Court can't overrule them. But they don't want to have the political fight among the people. They want to go to the Supreme Court. They've been depending on that for 30 years, and it's reached its end. It's run out to its dead end.
That's the voice of Jim Kavanaugh. You're also listening to John Jeter. You're listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. It's Friday. That means it's panel time. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. And there's more on the other side, so stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. It's Friday, so that means it's panel time, and we are so fortunate today. We've got with us John Jeter as well as Jim Kavanaugh. Gentlemen, thank you both for joining me and staying on board here. The activists quietly struggle to protect Venezuela's D.C. embassy from a U.S.-backed coup. There's an extraordinary chapter that's being written in the ongoing saga of what we call Venezuela, and it's gone virtually unnoticed. At the Venezuelan embassy in Georgetown in Washington, D.C., there's a group that calls themselves the Embassy Protection Collective. They're activists that are opposed to the prospect of the Venezuelan opposition taking over the Venezuelan embassy. They've been living in the building for the past 2 weeks. They've been working side by side with the skeletal Venezuelan diplomatic staff who has invited them in to do this. They were told by the State Department that they had to leave by April 24th. The protesters are still there, but many believe that the government will take action tomorrow or tomorrow evening to evict the established government representatives and the protesters who are there at the request of the Venezuelan government, remove them from the embassy and install Juan Guaido's henchmen. Jim Kavanaugh, your thoughts.
First of all, kudos to these people. You know, congratulations to them. They're doing exemplary work, and I wish I could be there to support them. I think the American government probably will go in soon and get them out, and it's horrible. I mean, it's a violation of diplomatic protocol, and it's just crazy. I mean, this is a complete, you know, hollow puppet government, the Guaido faction, and you know, but the Americans aren't giving up on it. So, but let's see if the media would even cover it. I mean, are they even covering this? Will they cover it if the police go in there and drag these people out?
No.
Nobody understands and sees the issue here, and that American citizens are seriously confronting and protesting against their own government's imperialist policies, invisible.
In fact, what I understand, John, is there's a clarion call that's been put out from those in the embassy to have as many people come down to the embassy for a show of force. I think this will force the hand of the media if there are enough protesters in the streets and in the embassy, this could actually wind up making the news. If it does, it'll be very interesting to see the spin that they put on it. John Jeter.
I have to be honest, and I don't want to be sort of a doomsayer or anything like that. I almost hope it doesn't make the news, because that might mean something really tragic happens, and I don't want to see that. Venezuela has suffered enough. Its people have suffered enough. And while, like Jim, I admire these people very much who are articulated their solidarity through action in this way, you know, this government is dangerous. It, you know, not to keep coming back to that same sort of analogy of the dying mule, but this animal is dangerous, and I don't want to see anything like that happen. This struggle between the United States government and the Venezuelan government, and people don't understand this largely because the media doesn't portray it this way. This is a struggle between good and evil. There's no other way to put that. The people who support Maduro, and before that supported Hugo Chavez, and let me say this, I lived in South Africa. I've been to Venezuela during Hugo Chavez's time. I have never seen a man so beloved by his people, and I include Nelson Mandela in this, as Hugo Chavez was when he was alive. I've never seen it. And particularly, if I can say, by black people, by black Venezuelans who represent 12% of that population, just like African-Americans do in the United States. And this is a battle between good and evil.
Take a step back and elaborate on that, because I got some folks that are across from me shaking their heads saying, no, there's no way that Hugo Chavez was more beloved by his people than Nelson Mandela. I won't even elaborate on what I know. You just go ahead and speak your piece.
Well, you know, and maybe this is a conversation we can have next week, right before the elections in South Africa. But the difference between Hugo Chavez, and I respect Mandela, even though I see the criticism of him. I understand the criticism of him. But the difference between Hugo Chavez and Nelson Mandela was that Hugo Chavez, in a very short period of time, produced material transformation for the poorest Venezuelans, for the blackest Venezuelans, for the mestizo population. Mandela did not live to see those changes occur, material changes in South Africa. And so that's the difference.
And wait a minute, you left out one thing. There are those in South Africa who believe at the end of his life he sold out the revolution. Mandela did.
Yeah, well, I think there are those who believe, and I think this has become particularly, I want to write about this soon, actually. I think this has become, there's been a heightened sense of this since the passing of Winnie Mandela, who was seen as part of that more progressive faction within the African National Congress, along with the assassinated Chris Hani, and that Mandela is seen increasingly, I think, particularly as a younger population comes of age, they don't remember the anti-apartheid struggle. Mandela is seen as, and I don't say this to be crude, I don't say this to be disrespectful, because I do respect Mandela and his legacy.
Right.
But I think he's seen as the white man's president, the white man's N-word.
Right.
I think that's how they feel. Yeah, and there's some reason to feel that way. And so I think, you know, to go back to Venezuela, I think that Chavez produced real change in a very short period of time. I mean, people, literacy rates and actual reducing poverty in less than a decade, even with a strike by the elites. So, you know, these things are
housing the homeless.
Real.
He
did so much. Some of the squatter laws that they have in Venezuela, I wish we had them in New York City and San Francisco, because we wouldn't have the homeless problem that we have there. So some of his ideas were visionary, even though I don't think he did enough. Right. I think Fidel Castro's one sort of recurring complaint to Hugo Chavez was, you need to stop talking about socialism so much and doing more socialism, right? And I think that's legitimate, right? But what he did was transformational, and I hope it becomes a blueprint, a model for how Americans think about our own transformation in the coming years and day, in the coming days and years.
Jim Kavanaugh, I know you want to get in.
Yeah, there is a point there that Mandela made a different deal with the ruling class and the oligarchy he was fighting against than Chavez did, although Chavez also made a kind of a deal with that. But Chavez instituted real changes in the lives of people and the working classes throughout the country, housing, health, medical care. I mean, you can't have free medical care here, but you can have it in Venezuela. I mean, this is, so, you know, that's for real. And, you know, when he was, they attempted to overthrow him in 2002, it was because the people found out where he was. The regime tried to tell him he had run off to Cuba. The people found out where he was and went there en masse to get him out. So, you know, this is the problem that the United States has, that the people are committed, the working classes are committed to the Bolivarian Revolution, no matter what real criticisms they have about how it's been going for the past 5 years or whatever. They're committed to it because they've gotten real benefits from it. And, you know, this is why this is going to be a horrible thing if the United States succeeds in, and what we're seeing in the embassy is kind of a little the iconic version of, you know, are they going to be able to tear the popular leaders out and replace them with puppets?
Well, in fact, John, thank you for that lead-in, Jim, because that takes me to my next question to the both of you. And I'll go to John first. Do you see the United States moving on the Venezuelan embassy in D.C. as trying to carve out some type of victory since they haven't been able to get Maduro out of Venezuela?
Very great. That's a great question. I'm sure. And you know, they want to make these power moves. This has been a poorly planned. I mean, we don't know. They still might succeed, at least in the short term. I think in the long term, the Venezuelan people will win this fight. But yeah, I mean, they have to save face. This has not gone the way they expected. In large part because, you know, imperialists have no imagination. They just do the same thing over and over again. Even when the circumstances change, the country changes, the language changes, everything changes. And so they just do the same thing. They try what they did in Chile, basically, and it didn't work. They can't find the military people who will rise up against Maduro or Chavez before him. And so, yeah, they're kind of at wit's end, and they need to make – yeah. I think that is reason to believe that tomorrow they will move in, you know, if nothing else to save face, such as it is for the American government, for the U.S. government right now.
Jim Kavanaugh, same question to you. Do you think the government moves on the embassy tomorrow in D.C. because they haven't been able to move on Maduro in Venezuela?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, they have to try and move forward. They have to try and show that this forward momentum and they're making progress. And, of course, the place they have the most control is Washington, D.C., you know. So if they can't get control of the situation in Georgetown, then they can't get control of the situation anywhere. So they will, as you say, demonstrate, you know, we can force our will in Georgetown, Washington, D.C. And that's what they have to do. They have to keep doing something. They have to keep moving forward. The other way they're moving forward, which is more dangerous and more horrible, are the sanctions, increasing the sanctions, which are costing already 40,000 lives. And, you know, this is all kabuki theater otherwise, because Guaido doesn't control anything, whoever's in that building.
Final, this is kind of the projection for next week. Let me start with you, John. What are the two or three things that you're looking at for next week?
Well, the one thing that I'm really sort of, you could almost say fixated on, and this is, I guess, maybe the week after. Well, I guess it's the week after next, but still, I'm looking for the lead into it. The elections in South Africa are May 8th. The polls all seem to suggest that the ANC has, the African National Congress in South Africa has lost support, but will still be the ruling party with the very Marxist-oriented party, the Economic Freedom Fighters, being in second or third place, but a distant second or third, even though their support is growing. I'm just not sure I believe that. I'm not sure if the polls are incorrect, just because they're not measuring the true sentiment out there, or because they're intentionally incorrect because they don't want the EFF to sort of rise. I don't know the answer, but I'm looking at sort of what the polls say going into the next election and what the media says in South Africa going into this election, because I think either way, something very dramatic is going to happen. Either the ANC is going to lose power, or they're going to have such a very slim majority that it's very clear that their people have lost faith in them. And so that to me is kind of what I'm kind of fixated on for the next, I guess, 10 days.
Okay. Jim Kavanaugh, what are the couple things that you're looking for? What should people pay attention to for next week?
Well, I think think this Venezuelan embassy issue is going to be play out in some way that's important, and we should keep attention on that. Of course, there'll be all kinds of brouhaha and blah, blah, blah about the Democratic primary situation, which I can't get excited about it. But I've kind of given up on trying to figure out what the next turn of events is going to be. You know, they're going to still be going on about some version of Russiagate and obstruction of justice and whether or not there's going to be impeachment. They're going to talk about that forever. So, you know, the things that are going on in the world that aren't getting attention, look at the yellow vests in France, which has been going on for 2 months. We haven't seen a thing about it in the American media. You know, we have the situation in Haiti, which has been going on for months. Haven't seen a thing about it in the American media. So it's hard to know what might happen in any of these situations that would become evident and become evident in the media next week.
And what's happening in Haiti is tied to what's going on in Venezuela.
Yeah.
And people aren't connecting those dots. Real quick, we have just about a minute left, and I want to get your guys' thoughts on this. I said last week, and I believe, give Joe Biden 4 or 5 days and look at the polls. And wherever Biden is polling in about 4 days is where Biden is going to stay. I think Biden has basically hit his stride already.
I heard an excellent. I saw an excellent tweet today. Joe Biden will never be more popular than he is today.
John Jeter, your thoughts?
Yeah, no, I agree. I agree completely, and I think the only thing that will keep him in the race is just that he'll have access to a lot of money. So you know that speaks.
Right.
But I don't see any way he can legitimately claim the nomination.
All right, Jim Kavanaugh, John Jeter, thank you, gentlemen, both. An incredible conversation today. Really, really appreciate your continued support and contribution to the Critical Hour. Gentlemen, have a wonderful weekend, and thank you both so much for coming on board today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Doc.
All right. All right, folks, you have been listening to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I want to thank you all for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here next week on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.